Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Harris, Judge Larkin, Judge Smith, the Honorable Jepal J. Harris presiding.
Thank you, counsel. I'd like to start by thanking you for your flexibility to moving this to Zoom. I understand that one of you made a request due to COVID. I hope you're feeling better in this matter. We are here today for court file A240607 in re the welfare of the child of JS. Counsel, you each will have 15 minutes in your argument. I will just note that before you begin arguing, please state your name. For the record, we are recording this and this will be released on our website after the argument. For those who are here observing, please note that during the argument, you are to keep your microphone on mute and keep your camera off. As I indicated, this is recorded and released on our website, so there is no unauthorized recording of this matter by individuals in the Zoom. With that, the appellant can start when you are ready.
Thank you, Your Honor, and good morning. May it please the court and counsel, my name is Brooke Beskow Ward, and I represent appellant mother J.S. in this appeal of the order terminating her parental rights to her child. Mother argues in this appeal that the procedures utilized by the district court were improper and violated her rights. Mother also contends that the district court overextended and improperly applied this court's decision in FFNM. For these reasons, mother asks this court to reverse the termination of parental rights order and remand to the district court for further proceedings. Appellant mother, as this court is aware, raises a number of issues in this appeal concerning both procedure and the court's order and findings. I'd like to start today with the issues one and two in my brief. The first issue was whether the district court abused its discretion when it excluded mother from the termination of parental rights trial. The second issue that sort of goes hand in hand is whether the district court erred as a matter of law and in violation of mother's statutory and rule-based rights and due process rights when it proceeded by default after excluding mother from the termination hearing. I know that.
Counsel, before you get into whether or not the district court abused its discretion by when it excluded mother from the hearing, could you first address whether, in fact, the district court excluded mother? The reason I ask that question is because FFNM, case that's relevant here, the exclusion happened when the district court directed the deputies to remove mother from the courtroom and the deputies escorted mother from the courtroom in handcuffs. In this case, we don't have deputies taking someone out of the courtroom in handcuffs pursuant to the judge's direction, which clearly indicates the person's not allowed to be in the courtroom.
Yes, Your Honor. And there are some factual differences in how the exclusion happened here in contrast to FFNM. Here, I do believe it was an exclusion. The court did ask mother to leave and noted prior to her asking her to leave that she would be asking her to leave a number of times if she were to disrupt the proceedings. I'd also direct the court to the district court's order denying mother's post-trial motion.
What did the district court do to communicate to mother and to us that, you know, if it asked mother to leave, mother went outside, calmed down, came back in, that mother would not have been allowed back in, that she truly would have been excluded from the remainder of the proceedings?
Your Honor, I don't know that the district court explicitly said that she would not be able to come back or did not indicate that to mother directly or to her counsel. However, she did ask her to leave from the proceedings, and I believe that that is an exclusion under Rule 38. The district court also noted in its order denying the post-trial motion on page 8 that the court removed mother from the courtroom due to her disruptive behavior is contemplated in Rule 3804. And so I think it is clear that the court did exclude her from the proceedings under that rule, or was at least proceeding with that in mind. I would also note the fact that the district court did state on the record that it was proceeding pursuant to FFNM. In that case, the mother was excluded. And as Your Honor noted, that exclusion was rather clear because she was removed by the deputies, and that the court was going to proceed in that manner pursuant to that case. So I do think the record is relatively clear that it was an exclusion under that rule. As this court is aware, parents do have a constitutionally protected fundamental right, and parents are entitled to fundamentally fair procedures in termination of parental rights cases. In a recent Minnesota Supreme Court case, In Re Welfare of GAH, the court noted that there is a strong statutory and constitutional preference in termination of parental rights cases to allow parents to have their day in court to refute the county's claim that the statutory—
Counsel, can I interrupt you? Because I think there's a lot going on in this case, and I do have quite a few questions. I apologize. In your view, if a district court in a child protection case says I'm proceeding by default, and the client, the parent is not present, but the parent's attorney is present and remains throughout the trial, what is that parent allowed to do and not allowed to do now that the district court has used the default label?
So I think that there is a difference between when a court proceeds by default under Rule 18 versus when a court proceeds after an exclusion under Rule 38.
Why is that? What's the difference, and why do you believe there's a difference in what's allowed?
Sure. In Rule 18, it says that the court, after proceeding by default, may admit evidence in support of the termination. The district court in this case does reiterate that portion of the rule, stating that in this case, because it was a default, albeit we argue improper default, that counsel for mother would not be able to submit any evidence, that she wouldn't have any evidence to submit in support of that termination.
The district court made a statement suggesting that the district court's belief was because this was going to be a default proceeding, mother's lawyer could not present any evidence opposing termination.
So in its order denying the post-trial motion, it does, again, page 7 to 8, state that mother would not be able to offer evidence in support of the petition, and that would be the only evidence that would be permitted under Rule 18. That is stated in page 8.
Chair of authority that supports that proposition, that when a court is proceeding by default in a termination case, and the parent's lawyer is there ready and willing to offer evidence in defense of the termination, such evidence is not allowed.
Your Honor, I don't believe that we have any precedential case law on that point saying that that is how a default proceeding should occur. We have the plain language of the rule, and I will say that I've seen in practice that that is generally how it is applied. That okay. When there is
a— So you're saying being read to mean that the only evidence that can be presented is evidence in support of the termination. So if a parent's lawyer is there, has evidence, wants to present that evidence to the court in an effort to avoid termination on behalf of her client, the lawyer can't present that evidence.
Your Honor, I would say that that is how I have seen it apply, that when the district court is proceeding in default, it is no longer viewed as a contested matter. It is viewed as a matter where the department gets to put on its case with evidence in support of that termination.
All right. Again, here's what's interesting on that point. In a matter of welfare of the child of HD, D, a 2021 case from the Minnesota Supreme Court, the Minnesota Supreme Court reiterated what's in Rule 18, which is even when a parent fails to appear, the state still has the burden to prove its case by clear and convincing evidence. This is not a civil default proceeding. In a civil setting, if there's a default, that means that the plaintiff doesn't have to prove anything, unless, of course, the judge were to say, you know, I'm not sure what your damages are. I want to hear some evidence on damages. But for the most part, a default means you get judgment as requested in your complaint. Mm-hmm. And the Supreme Court made it clear in HGD that that is not what happens in a child protection case. And the thing in this case, although it did not address, and I think you're right, there really isn't precedential case law addressing what may and may not happen in a default proceeding if we're in a default proceeding. The Supreme Court noted in that case, mother's attorney who was present did not object to testimony provided by the social worker or did not cross-examine the social worker. Mother's attorney did not cross-examine another witness. Mother's attorney did not present any witnesses or any evidence. And after hearing closing arguments, which suggests that mother's attorney did make a closing argument. And what I find interesting about this opinion is, why would the Supreme Court be noting mother's attorney's failure to object to testimony, cross-examine witnesses, and failure to call witnesses, and failure to present any evidence, if in fact mother's attorney was not allowed to do so in that proceeding? Suggesting to me that a default proceeding in a child protection context is, again, very different than what we have in the civil context, not only in terms of the need to prove up the case, but also in terms of whether or not the defaulting parent, if represented by counsel who is ready and able to defend, should be allowed to defend.
Yes, Your Honor, and I am aware of that language in HGD. I would say that, again, we don't have a precedential case saying that that is how the hearing in a default matter should or needs to go. I will say that in practice, generally in default, it becomes an uncontested matter based on the language of the rule, which says that only evidence in support of the petition.
Does the rule say only, or is only a word people are reading into the rule?
Your Honor, I can certainly grab the rule here. I have it and I can double check.
Okay. And then I can check that too. My next question for you, and then I think I'm done, is, let's say your position has some merit, that even though a person is in default, that doesn't mean that their lawyer, who is present and ready and willing to defend against the termination, cannot do so. I'm not seeing anything in the briefing or in my limited review of the record that indicates, other than perhaps this one statement by the district court judge that indicates the district court was not going to allow or not going to hear any evidence that was against termination. I mean, is there any indication that mother's lawyer said, I'd like to cross-examine this witness, or I have a few questions, or I'd like to make an objection, and the judge said, no, you can't do that, this is a default?
There is not, Your Honor. I would note that initially when the parties were discussing, the parties in the court were discussing the admission of exhibits, the court essentially, mother had objected to two exhibits before the start of trial, which the counsel for the department did put on the record. And then the court indicates that, no, this is default. And the county then offers all of the exhibits and the court accepts all of them. So the court, it seems, is at a minimum suggesting that mother's attorney has no role in this proceeding anymore now that it has become a default proceeding. I also just want to back up one step and note that mother's argument is that this is an improper default, because a default cannot occur unless a parent fails to appear.
In Let this me ask case, you that. What does appear mean? I think traditionally, in the legal world, appear means you show up to a court proceeding and you participate in it, you take a position, you oppose. Just, I mean, is your position that, well, if mother showed up to the courthouse walked into the courtroom, sat down with her lawyer at counsel table, and then got up and left. She's appeared?
Well, she in this case, she certainly appeared. She started testifying. She was participating in the proceedings, and she was physically present. Again, in most of these cases, the court seemed to interpret that as physical presence in the courtroom. There have been cases where parents have attempted to appear remotely or virtually over Zoom, and unless the court has already said that a parent may do so, that is considered a default in many court in the eyes of many courts. That has happened. And so again, some clarification around what is and what is not a default would certainly be helpful. This case should not have been a default proceeding. Mother appeared and the court excluded her from the hearing. Well, that takes us down a whole different route in terms of analysis in an exclusion case where we are proceeding under Rule 38 and a parent.
Let me ask you this. What if we were to disagree that this was an exclusion because, you know, the court saying, I'm going to ask you to leave, and mother saying, well, I was already leaving and getting up and leaving without the court doing anything to physically have her removed or restrained or otherwise indicate that mother wasn't allowed back? I mean, here we have the court saying, I'll keep the record open. You can bring your client back in. Do you want to bring your client back in at the end? That does not sound like an exclusion.
I think that would require this court, and I see my time is just about up. May I finish my response?
You may.
Thank you. Is an exclusion in this case because that would require, if this court were to say this is not an exclusion, that would require this court to disregard a finding made by the district court that this was indeed an exclusion. And I don't know that that is proper. I don't know that this court can simply disregard a finding that the district court made, unless that were to be clearly erroneous, which in this case, I don't believe that it is. The district court asked mother to leave and said that the court was going to ask mother to leave at occasions if mother was disruptive.
Judge Harris, may I just have one follow-up?
You may.
Okay. So what you're saying is, you know, regardless of whether or not this looks like an exclusion, the district court said it was an exclusion in its findings, and therefore, you know, we've got to treat it, okay, the district court says it's an exclusion. Was it a proper exclusion? And if it wasn't a proper exclusion, what happens? If it was a proper exclusion, did the district court further err by treating this as a default when we said in the last case that if it's an exclusion, it's not a default. They're two different things, two different rules. And then another question is, in my mind at least, when you have, okay, a true default, parent does not show up, but parents, I mean, my practice went one of two ways. Parent doesn't show up. The lawyer would say, I met my client once at the EPC hearing. Despite my best efforts, I've not been able to locate my client or communicate with my client. I'm in no position to defend my client against the termination. It would be, you know, I feel it would be unethical for me to do that. So I'm requesting withdrawal from counseling as counsel, and I'm gone. And then what happens, happens. Another possibility is the lawyer says, look, my client's made seven appearances. I'm in touch. I have no idea why she's not here. Don't do a default. Continue. The court says, no, we're having a hearing. And then the court says, or the lawyer says, well, I'm going to defend this and I want full participation. Is what's supposed to happen then in a default setting different than what's supposed to happen or allowed to happen in the Rule 38 setting, where the court says your client can't be in the courtroom, we've got to do this trial, not excluding the lawyer, mom needs to be in the hallway, and then we sort of presume that the lawyer is going to defend the case. Does case law give us any guidance on whether the default with an attorney there ready to defend should look any different than the procedure under Rule 38, where a client did appear, but they're not behaving and the clients that are ready to defend?
So first of all, Your Honor, for the initial part of your question, your line of analysis is Those are the steps that I would take in the analysis here. As to the second part of your question, the difference between Rule 18 and Rule 38, I do believe there is a difference. If we are going to interpret Rule 18 to say that that becomes an uncontested trial, then Rule 38 is certainly different when we proceed with an exclusion where the attorney and the rule explicitly states that the attorney gets to stay there. That attorney absolutely gets to participate on behalf of that parent when that parent is excluded from the hearing. Whether they get to a true default proceeding is sort of an open question that we do not have a solid answer on yet. Would I like to see that a parent attorney gets to defend at a default proceeding? Absolutely. Has it been interpreted in the other way, at least at the district court level? It has.
Understood. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Nicholson.
Thank you. Good morning to the court and counsel, and may it please the court. My name is Britta Nicholson from the Hennepin County Attorney's Office. I am appearing today on behalf of the respondent in this matter, Hennepin County Child Protection, who I will refer to as the department throughout the argument this morning. I would like to begin by addressing the crux of this case, which at its core is a due process challenge. And regardless of whether the appellant's absence is viewed as a Rule 18 default or a Rule 38 exclusion, the district court did provide appellant with due process in this case, consistent with the opinion in FFNM, which noted that the exact same due process standards apply to both a Rule 18 default and a Rule 38 exclusion.
And what are those standards? What are the requirements?
The case law is very clear that due process is a very flexible analysis, that the amount afforded in each particular case is based on the unique circumstances of that case.
Isn't it generally notice and an opportunity to be heard? I think opportunity to be heard is always part of the equation. So is due process violated if a lawyer is there on behalf of her client and says, I would like my client to be heard through the evidence I want to present, through the arguments I want to make?
And my response to that is twofold. First and foremost, as discussed in the FFNM opinion, the parent in a Rule 38 or Rule 18 situation does have the opportunity to present their evidence. There is a trial, everybody's there, ready to go. And then through their own conduct, either failing to appear or behaving in a manner that requires exclusion, they forfeit that right. So they did have the opportunity, just through their choices and actions, chose not to exercise it.
Well, counsel, in this case, you know, did the mother forfeit her rights by her conduct? In looking at Rule 38.04, part of that rule says that when someone is excluded, the court needs to place on the record the reason for the exclusion and that the parent is being excluded. And looking at this record, you know, it seems to me, you know, mom was late. And then there's the opening statement. Mom makes one interruption where she says, excuse me, I'm not going to sit here. And then the court notes that she's leaving the courtroom. They give a break for the attorney to speak with mom and then tells mom if there's further disruptions that she's going to exclude her. Mom comes back. Then we go back to page 7 where the court says that if you can't control your behavior, you'll need to leave. There's nothing in the record that that this court can see between the first admonishment and this admonishment what behavior that would need to be controlled. And then she indicates that she's going to leave. She goes to the stand after being told after telling the court she's going to leave, she still takes the stand. She places herself under oath. She begins to answer questions. She asks to speak to her attorney, which the court denies, saying that she's not going to allow her to speak to her attorney. We're going now to page 10 of the transcript, you know, asking why is the individual who earlier gave an opening statement in which mom sat there and listened to her indicate how she's not, you know, fit parent and so on and so forth. Why is this person questioning me? The court's response is merely, this is the process. And the witness says it should be someone totally different. I don't like sitting here and being questioned by her. And then the court says, Miss Tour, I'm going to ask you to leave the courtroom. And then we have a discussion about it being a default, and that the basis is in re the matter of the child of FM. There's nothing in the transcript in which the court identifies that I'm excluding mom, and these are the reasons that I'm excluding mom. So my question is, now we're sitting here trying to figure out whether it's an exclusion and why it's an exclusion. Again, what conduct did, when we have a transcript that is so devoid of the conduct that mom did, why isn't the response that we remanded so the court can make a better record as to why mom was excluded?
And Your Honor, I do believe that the court did make those additional findings in its subsequent order denying the motion for a new trial. It talks about.
But counsel, you understand the rule doesn't say that the findings need to be made in a previous order. It says the finding has to be made on the record. So again, in reading the transcript, and I would love for you to point out to me where on the record, when this is happening in real time, did the court make a finding that mom is being excluded and state specifically the basis and the reason for that exclusion?
And well, Your Honor, I think that goes back to the crux of the issue where in the district court's proceedings, it wasn't viewed as an exclusion. I would note, well, counsel did on oral argument reference, again, the order after, sorry, just let me find it here. The order issued after the post-trial motions, that order is very clear that the district court did not consider it an exclusion. It mentions, for example, on page 5 that she voluntarily absented herself and did not return, that she was in the process of voluntarily removing herself from the courtroom, that she was not excluded from trial by actions of this court. That's on page 6. And there is additional discussions on that court, on that page discussing the court did not at any appellant from returning to the courtroom and rejoining the proceedings. So therefore, from the court's perspective, it was not a Rule 38 exclusion. So that is why the district court did not say, I have excluded mother and put on the records, here are the reasons for the exclusion. She did ask her to step outside, as she had previously done, to take a breather and then return to the courtroom. And then in that process, that is when the appellant said, basically, it's too late, I'm already leaving. And the record is also clear that the district court was willing to let appellant return and to engage and have her full contested trial, even leaving the record open till the end of the day. So therefore, that's further evidence that it was not an exclusion as considered by the district court, and in fact, that it was a situation where the appellant voluntarily left.
I want to go back to your reference to the FFNM case and the application of the forfeiture doctrine in that case, because I think you were talking about due process and saying, yes, mother had all these rights. She forfeited them by leaving and referred us to FFNM. But FFNM is very different than this case because in that case, mother discharged her counsel and was proceeding pro se. So when we said she forfeited her right to participate in the hearing, she was the only one that would have participated in the hearing. Here we have a lawyer who's in the courtroom, who's remaining in the courtroom, who's been told you'll have the opportunity to supplement the record and bring your client back in. And at the same time, a judge, apparently leading all to believe that it wasn't going to hear objections from the lawyer, it wasn't going to accept evidence from the lawyer. So, I mean, how do we reconcile that? How does a person forfeit their right to participate in the proceeding when they have a lawyer there that's willing to participate on their behalf, which was not the circumstance in NN FFNM?
And that is definitely a different factual circumstance. And the point I was trying to make, and I believe the district court was trying to make in referencing FFNM, was again the overall due process point where the procedures were largely the same and the, there was evidence in the form of testimony, and exhibits, and, you know, various opportunities that were given to the appellant before she was, in that case, excluded from the courtroom and forbidden from returning. And that basically, since the district court made an order based on evidence, as opposed to just based purely on her failure to appear, that she did receive due process. So
why
the analysis
would we
there,
say that due process is satisfied if a client is removed from the courtroom, doesn't appear, whatever reason, the party's not there, but the party's represented by counsel. So it's anticipated that counsel is going to defend the case, call witnesses, do everything. Why would we say due process is satisfied if an absent party's attorney, absent for whatever reason, if an absent party's attorney is there and willing to represent the client's interests in the case?
Well, in this case, the attorney's client or appellant's attorney did remain in the courtroom, and the district court did not at all prevent the attorney from participating in the proceedings on behalf of her client.
But the
For
district
example,
court made statements such as, well, yes, you objected to these documents before, but now this is a default. So, and then made a statement indicating that the only evidence the court would hear would be evidence in support of a TPR, you know, communicating that client or counsel should not attempt to present any evidence in opposition to the TPR. How does that satisfy due process?
Well, regarding the exhibits that were stipulated to, that I think that was just making a record. And this goes again to my prejudice argument. And I would just like to touch on that briefly, because this entire case can be resolved based on the prejudice issue alone, as was noted in the GAH case, which was a due process issue after a appellant was defaulted. And in that case, the court said it wasn't even necessary to reach the due process issues and challenges raised by the appellant.
Is that a case where the lawyer was there and willing to defend the case?
The lawyer was present in GAH, yes.
Okay. And what is the cite for that case, please? I appreciate that.
Yes. That is 998 Northwest 2nd 222. And that was a case decided at the Supreme Court in 2023. And in that case, they complained, for example, very similar to this case, that the appellant's attorney was not allowed to cross-examine a key witness, the guardian ad litem. And in GAH, the court pointed out that there was no proffer in post-trial motions or at the appellate level of what difference that would have made in the case. And the same is true here. And for example, when
does,
we talk
okay,
about-
Okay, does exhibit, that, and I'm looking for answers here, I'm not trying to argue, but does that suggest that that lawyer would have perhaps been entitled to cross-examine the guardian ad litem, but the reason he wasn't getting any traction in the appeal is because he didn't make an offer of proof showing that that cross-examination would have been fruitful?
In GAH, they just declined to reach a conclusion about whether due process had been violated, because their ultimate conclusion was that the case could be resolved and it was dispositive on the prejudice issue alone. And I do address that angle in my brief as well, that, you know, it there. Well, first of all, I would also note that the district court did not prevent appellant's counsel from cross-examining. Counsel did not ask to cross-examine, did not make any efforts to cross-examine. So it is purely speculative that that request would have been denied. And at this point, we're at the situation where appellant's counsel is present in the courtroom and made some strategic choices about what rights to exercise and what not. For example, she did object to the default. She asked to leave the record open to make a closing argument, which was granted. She asked to leave the record open to submit voluntary paperwork, which was granted. She did have a role in the proceedings. She did respond when she was asked by department's counsel, is this correct about our stipulations to exhibits? She did say yes. So there were various points in the proceedings where appellant's counsel made the choice about which rights of her clients to exercise. She'd made perhaps a strategic choice to largely remain silent during testimony, to not attempt to offer any exhibits, even though the district court did say, you know, I will leave the record open until the end of the day. I'm not sure what you would submit to that end, but the record is left open. So appellant's counsel did have opportunities, but merely made the strategic choice not to exercise those opportunities. And while appellant may now be disappointed with that and wish that the attorney had done something differently or been more active or more assertive, that is not a grounds for a reversal on appeal, especially when there is a complete lack of prejudice and no demonstration of She never filed an exhibit list. There's no mention in post-trial motions or on appeal what exhibits she would have presented if given the opportunity. She didn't file timely objections as required by the scheduling order to the department's exhibits and then stipulated to all but two exhibits. And those remaining two exhibits, there's still no record of what the specific objection was, and therefore any objection likely would have been deemed waived by virtue of the scheduling order. Furthermore, while the appellant did file a witness list that included herself, she forfeited that right when she refused to testify and then left the courtroom. She filed a witness list that had three other witnesses on it. But again, in the post-trial motions and now on appeal, there's no offer of proof about if those witnesses would have even shown up, what they would have testified to, and how that would have changed the outcome of these proceedings when the record is so incredibly clear that appellant did not remedy the mental health issues that brought this case in, and that she was even experiencing active emotional dysregulation issues at the time of the trial, as evidenced by her leaving the courtroom. The department had worked with this parent for approximately 16 months with no noticeable change in behavior. She has an extensive child protection history dating back to 2015, had none of her children in her care. The record is just overwhelmingly clear that a termination of parental rights was supported by the record, and therefore there was no prejudice in this case, and the court can decide the case on that issue alone. I see I've used all of my time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Ward.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to address a few points here, counsel's characterization of appellant mother's counsel at the district court, that these were strategic decisions about what she could offer, I think that mischaracterizes the record. I do want to state, you know, on page 11 of the transcript, when counsel did object to the default, she asked that the court hold the record open so that she could submit any closing arguments. The district court's response was, I'm not sure what you would offer in the end, but I'll leave the record open for you. I think it becomes pretty clear as we look through the transcript and then read it in conjunction with the district court's order denying the post-trial motion that the district court did not intend to allow mother's counsel to participate in these proceedings. That is problematic. That is a violation of mother's statutory rule-based and procedural due process rights, and that needs a remedy. In this case, and I would note that counsel is correct that the GAH case did discuss prejudice following a default procedure. I would note that in that case, the counsel for the mother did offer, you know, some statements and I believe an affidavit about testimony that would have been elicited. The Supreme Court ultimately found that that was not sufficient to overcome what the district court had found, but that proffer was made. In this case, the prejudice, I would point to the district court's order and the inadequacy of the order, which I point out in my brief. We have insufficient reasonable efforts findings. We have best interest findings that are not supported by the record. And we also have the district court improperly applying the presumption of palpable unfitness, which clearly did not apply in this case because that order out of North Carolina was not issued until this trial concluded. So we have a number of inadequacies and improper decisions made in that district court order, which I would point to as prejudice following this proceeding.
Counsel, can you explain at the point where the due process violation was about that you allege was about to be made, it was when the court granted the opportunity to the department to proceed by default. And at that point, I would think, I was looking for, okay, what did they say we can no longer present as evidence? You know, there's no discussion of the witnesses that they wanted to present, what the proffer was with respect to that or any exhibits. How, I'm trying to understand, you know, later, you know, the infirmities that you allege with respect to the order, how that really relates to proceeding by default.
Well, in terms of the reasonable efforts, I think that, you know, that was likely going to be challenged by mother's counsel, and the result of an undeveloped record is that, and an uncontested record is that we have deficient findings to uphold a termination of parental rights.
It was going to be challenged, but in what way? By presenting some testimony or evidence that's not been proffered and described to us?
Yes, Your Honor. And I understand that that did not happen in this case. I would argue that it was likely going to be brought out through cross-examination, which it generally is. But Your Honor is correct that it was not offered in this case. I do believe, though, that we have a deficient order here that was a result of this uncontested proceeding where mother's counsel was not able to offer anything in order to defend her client's rights. I would also touch on Your Honor Harris's point that there were other procedural deficiencies in this matter, including not accurately, or not, I should say, not complying with Rule 38 as it stands. There are some holes here, but I also think that ultimately the record shows that the court, the district court, intended to exclude mother. The court did exclude mother. The court made a finding that it excluded mother, and it then improperly proceeded by default. Because
what precisely is the finding that it excluded mother? You, both of you, I know, interpreted, seems, the post-trial order differently. So point me to the language where you say it's a finding to help me out there.
On page 8, it says the court appropriately proceeded in the manner it did, as mother was both disruptive to the trial proceedings as contemplated in Minnesota Rule of Juvenile Protection Procedure 3804, and she voluntarily absented herself from the trial and was therefore in default pursuant to Minnesota Rule of Juvenile Protection Procedure 1801. So the court did make both of those findings. I would note in FFNM, the court made a similar finding that mother voluntarily absented herself from the trial, even though mother was excused in handcuffs. And so that language is a little bit confusing here, but the court makes an explicit finding that it was proceeding under Rule 3804, the exclusionary rule. And I see my time is up, so I will just ask this court to reverse and remand to the district court for further proceedings. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. With that, this matter is submitted. We will issue an opinion within the statutory time frame. I'd like to thank you both for appearing via Zoom. With that, that does conclude this hearing. We do have one additional non-oral argument. And with that, that concludes the hearing. Thank you all.
Thank you.